everyone in podcast land and NPR land, and welcome back to the Front Row Podcast, the podcast for people who actually like movies. And you're next in our series of Oscar spotlights for 2020. This is where we're going to give you all the breakdowns of all of the most nominated films. And then, of course, we're going to break down the categories, because you know why? Because we're psychotic, because all we want to do is give you content, people. So I'm Jeremy Gechner, the editor-in-chief. I am so psyched today to be joined by our good friend, our regular here on the Front Row Network, Mr. Jay Hoffman. What's up, Jay?
Hey, how's it going?
Going pretty good here, pretty good. We're in the thick of the Oscar races here, man.
Yeah, I've been putting it to the grindstone to watch all these movies, man.
You have. I think you are way ahead of everyone on watching the screeners. I really do, because I have not watched as many as I want. But we did just.
Well, get I haven't slept as much as I want.
We just got 1917, but I'm actually going to go watch that in Florida on vacation with my wife and mother-in-law. So I can't watch it yet. So I got to just wait on it. But.
Are you seeing it in theaters?
Yes. Yes, we are.
It is a theater movie for sure.
That's what I hear. That's why I'm not lamenting not watching the screener either way. But we're not here to talk about 1917, although you can catch Jay Hoffman on that upcoming Oscar spotlight. No, we are here to talk about somehow the most nominated film this year. It got the most Oscar nominations this year. We are talking about Todd Phillips's Joker. We did a mini full disclosure on this. I did one solo when it first came out all the way back in October. And, you know, Jay rightly pointed out to me that, like, I think this movie deserves a little bit more than a mini full disclosure. And I agree. And apparently the Academy does as well. So we're going to give it to you right here, right now, a bigger breakdown of this. Well, so you guys have obviously heard what some of my thoughts were on this film, although they've evolved a little bit. But Jay, let's start with you. Obviously, this film stars Joaquin Phoenix as the DC comic villain in sort of a origin story of sorts. What did you think overall of the movie Joker when you saw it, not only for the first time, but when you also rewatched it for this podcast?
When I initially saw it, I loved it. And the second time I watched it, I liked it more.
Yeah. Okay.
But I think I need another three or four viewings of it to make my final decision.
Yeah.
I think there's just a lot to, there's just so much you got to catch. And I actually actively took notes while I was watching yesterday, just because there's so much stuff I was catching. I totally didn't even cue in on it all.
Yeah.
The first time I watched it. Now, I said I loved it when we're putting it in the spotlight of the best picture nominations and the most nominations overall. That's surprising to me. It's probably in the middle of the pack for me so far of the best pictures. I loved it, but it's also not a movie I'm going to watch, but once every year or two. a little too heavy, a little too dark. You got to be in a mood for it, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. And I was the same way. So, like, when I first saw it, I was a little bit more tepid on it. You know, I was just kind of like, I was a lot like you, that there's just a lot of stuff to take in with this movie. There's a lot of stuff that's happening here. Some of it makes more sense than others, but, you know, the overall feeling, though, is like once I saw it a second time, I started to kind of get what its message was. Now, again, my thoughts have kind of evolved on that a little bit too in talking. This is what I find is the defining characteristic of this movie, though, is that you, every time you see it, every time you talk about it with someone, it seems to be an ever evolving thing, this film, like what you think of it. I will say, I think that the one thing you can't, that stays constant the whole time is Joaquin Phoenix's performance here. Now he's racking up the awards wins. He's seemingly as much of an Oscar lock as you can get at this point in the season. But, you know, I've seen certain people that have tried to kind of downgrade his performance as just like, you know, a laughing man performance. And I just don't get that, Jay. So like, what were your thoughts initially on his performance alone?
I loved it. And some of those people are in the Front Row Network. There was a weird attack going on yesterday. And
every time
I tried to defend it, everybody just ignored me. So that was like, no.
I'm telling you, man, the chat, the Front Row chat in Oscar season has gotten crazy, folks.
Yeah.
Can't even describe it.
I thought it was great. And there was an article in Vanity Fair where they interviewed a neurocriminologist, which sounds like a made-up position. He studies violent criminals, you know, and he studies people with certain mental illnesses. And you know, he said he was shocked when he saw it because of how accurate they displayed some of the tendencies and things like that. So he wasn't just playing some, you know, crazy guy, as I've seen people say. He was digging into the mental illness and digging into some of the factors that create violent people in society. And I think there were times when he was subtle, times when he was, you know, really digging into the madness he was going into. And I don't know. I loved it. It's haunting what he does with it.
Yeah.
I thought he was great.
Yeah. And, you know, like when you think about it, I mean, it's just like you think about Arthur Fleck in this movie. I mean, he really is kind of the 20th century version of the Book of Job, I think. It's just how many bad things can happen. So, I mean, like when the second time I saw this, I was watching it with my wife, Sarah, and she, like, literally every about 10 minutes in this movie, she was just like, oh no. Like, it's just every single time, it's just like there's just so few moments of joy at all in this man's life in this movie. And that kind of is the interesting part of it, because, you know, when we did our best movies of the year, when we did our collective article for NPR, I kept coming back to so many different dramas and so many different dramas that I liked, but for some reason, this one just sticks with you. And I think it's because of the character of Arthur. Now, you know, initially, I think that, you know, the movie does a very good job of slowly unraveling Arthur's, you know, very few remaining strands of sanity. You know, by the time we meet him, he's already, you know, pretty far gone. Like, the very first shot of this movie is him forcing himself to smile almost to the point of ripping his cheeks off, you know, in a mirror, while a single tear rolls down his face with his clown makeup smearing. And, you know, it's one of those things you just see and you're like, okay, that's what we're playing with. But then, like, literally every little thing that he holds on to try and keep his sanity is slowly ripped away from him in this movie. You know, he idolizes Murray Franklin on the Gotham version of The Tonight Show. Slowly that gets ripped away from him, which is also the final straw of his sanity that gets taken away. He thinks his mom is like this honest lover, you know, like loving person of him when she's really been lying to him. And, oh, by the way, responsible for the big mental illness that he has in his life. It's, you know, he has a job he loves, but is constantly being berated there. And I mean, it's just, there's nothing here. I mean, like, what was your reaction to kind of like that inherent pessimism of Arthur's character and what he goes through?
Well, my reaction is there's a reason that I said you can only watch this movie once in a while.
Right.
it's definitely heavy. But I was reflecting back when you and Ryan did the Oscar spotlight and you guys were talking about the director, something popped out to me because you said of the weakest directors, even though they're all strong, maybe Todd Phillips. And I was like, I don't know. So when you talk about the diving into madness, there's something that stood out to me this last time I watched it. And it was every shot where there was steps involved.
Uh-huh.
Every time there's stairs, he's going down them. Only one time in the movie does he go up the stairs, and that's right after he gets jumped in the very beginning, and he's trudging up these stairs like it's like his last bit of trying to push through his mental illness and depression. Every other time he goes down a flight of steps, he goes down. He never goes up.
That's interesting.
First one, he gets fired. He goes down a step and opens a door to this bright light.
Mm-hmm.
You know? The next time he goes down, he finds out his mother was the cause of his mental illness.
Yeah.
And the last time he goes down is the iconic scene where he's dancing down the steps. That's when he's fully embraced the madness at that point in time. So to me, it felt like the steps represented of him marching down this trajectory deeper and deeper into this madness. And I have no idea why that stood out to me this last time I watched it. Every time there's steps, something big happened right after it.
Great.
It felt like it was leading us right into when he goes into his full madness. So not only was it just it's heavy because he's getting so crushed under all these bad things, but I think they did a good job of leading you, seeing you like actually seeing him go down this trajectory into his madness.
Yeah. You're right. And that's a great metaphor that's being used there. I didn't catch that, but now as I'm remembering it, you're absolutely right. Like that's a crazy thing that they did here. And I mean, like, yeah, it's, you know, Arthur is, it's interesting to me. So like the first person that told me like they didn't like his performance, it was a Facebook, you know, debate, which always ends well. But it turned into like, he thought that like the laughing like was just like bad community theater. And I was like, man, I don't think you're watching close enough. Like, cause what Joaquin Phoenix is doing with these laughing fits. And I thought it was actually quite an ingenious thing to make him, you know, make it be an involuntary thing, you know, like it is part of his mental illness here is that he cannot control it. And it's during times of high stress and high anxiety, you know, social or any other kind that he's feeling. And like, there are certain times when you see him in one of these laughing fits and you can see it on his face that he so badly wants to stop and he can't, he just cannot make himself stop. Yeah. It's most stringent. And I think it's most stark on the train where the three guys start beating him up. And I mean, like there's such a great job that he's doing there of laughing at it, but also showing in those brief little break moments of how terrified he actually is on that train as well. And of course that is also the catalyst moment that starts his full descent into madness, as you said. What did you think of that decision to make the laughing not like a symptom of like, oh, you know, I'm mad now, but more of like, this is something that has been done to him?
No, I loved, and I liked, in addition to him fighting, he always looked like he was writhing in pain.
Uh-huh.
Like when he was laughing, it was like a weird juxtaposition to hear and see.
Yeah, like his body even tenses up so much, you know?
Yeah. You want a bad community theater Joker laugh, that's Jared Leto.
We're just not going to talk about Jared Leto. Hey, Morbius looks all right. Let's talk there.
There you go.
Oh, God. Yeah. But I mean, well, and here's something I want to get your opinion on, too, because, again, it's so tied into the character of Arthur here, though. But obviously the movie has come under some scrutiny and some blame casting on it, that it is making us sympathize with an inherently evil character, and that maybe it's trying to humanize people that do these kinds of dastardly deeds. You know, I think, yeah, I mean, I think there's two ways to think about that, but I kind of want to hear your opinion on that first. Like, do you think that the film falls prey to that it's kind of not glorifying, I guess, but you know, like that it's kind of giving excuse to this particular character and maybe toward the real life contemporaries that happens in the real world?
I did not think it was glorifying or excusing the behavior. What I do for a living, I'm a safety instructor, right?
Right, exactly.
Is find root cause.
Yeah.
Right. What's the cause? And so to me, this is exploring the root cause of all this stuff. Because mm-hmm. in the media, it's always they're mentally deranged or this or that. It's not all the, you know, large amount of variables that, and I think he's trying to show, you know, it's not one thing that he had. It was, man, he had all, just like you said, it's constant, one thing after the next. And the line Joker says when he's on the Murray show about thinking of other people's viewpoints.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's excusing it. I think it's trying to go, hey, there's a reason that this is like a trend that's happening.
Yeah.
And we can either try to blame one thing or explore the multitude of variables that causes this to happen.
Yeah.
But the fact that this is a Joker movie, I think, you know, we say we feel for the person. Well, part of that is there's a reason like Joker's by far like everybody's favorite comic book villain. You know, he embraces chaos in a way that we all wish we could. Mm-hmm. I'm the kind of guy that if there's a few pieces of laundry and toys on the floor, like my brain can't function. There's no way I could embrace chaos.
Right.
So I think just the very nature of being Joker, we already are like, oh, it's the Joker. You know, like that's why we love Heath Ledger, because you're like, man, he just embraced that chaos. He's evil, but there's something to the Joker that we all, I think, are a little jealous of.
Yeah.
So when you throw that into a movie where it takes a lot more of a real world look at it, I think it confuses the issue.
Yeah, and I definitely want to break down the Murray Franklin show scene more with you. And also, but like, that's interesting because, like, you know, obviously there's not much depth to the Joker when he first appears in the Detective Comics, you know, like in Clown Prince of Crime. I mean, Cesar Romero wasn't doing a take on the Joker. That's what people thought the Joker was at the time, you know, and, you know, you didn't have much to differentiate it, but you're right. Like once you hit late '60s, early '70s, and then definitely once you hit the Frank Miller era in the '80s and such, the Joker, you're right, starts taking on a more philosophical face and more of a anarchist, chaotic, kind of the polar opposite of the order that Batman tries to instill in Gotham City. And seeing that take root in Arthur, not because, you know, I remember seeing a meme that was like, you know, the, you know, Batman 1989, like create the Joker, throw him into toxic chemicals, you know, Joker 2019, throw him into society. And I thought that's kind of like the point of this. And that, you know, like in the sense that like it is that, you know, the idea here, the big idea I think the film is trying to play with is that idea of what happens to a person, a vulnerable person, when society so blatantly doesn't care about them. And when, you know, they're meant to rely on certain aspects of that society, but then those can be ripped away, like the social worker or the medications. You know, like what happens when, you know, this person that you wouldn't think would be such a big threat, you know, kind of fully embraces the downside of what he sees every day. And so I think there is a societal message to this that sticks out. And I can see how some critics take that to, you know, you are giving excuse to that then, you know, you're saying like, oh, if this has happened to you, you know, now you have somebody that can like look up to. I think that the other counter argument to that is that anybody who wants to emulate what the Joker does in this movie is clearly not a well person, you know, and I can see that point, but yeah. You know, I just think that it's trying to make a bigger point about an uncaring society more than it is, you know, a portrait of a, you know, sympathetic psychopath. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I fully agree with that. And just tie that in with another thing. You know, I think there's a reason they said it in the 80s and made Gotham to kind of replicate what New York was like in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
I also think, you know, he's not going to get that reaction if he's on a talk show now.
Right.
But in the 80s, I mean, everybody would have been watching that show.
Yeah.
So it
yeah,
would make
absolutely.
Sense that like such a huge amount of people saw it and bought, you know, I don't think people would buy into that issue. That's a pessimistic view, but.
Right. just
but
a
that's
little.
How it works in the movie. So I think there's some reasons they put it in that time frame too, because I don't think his message comes across in the viral age, you know, I think it would disappear. So I think they said it in the 80s for a reason. And so they could clearly replicate many of the influences of the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the more interesting characters in this movie to me is Thomas Wayne, because, you know, it's such a different portrait that we've ever seen of Thomas Wayne. You know, you look back to Batman Begins, and it's usually what we always see of Thomas Wayne, which is a very altruistic, very philanthropic, good-hearted person that's trying to save a city that might be beyond saving, but he's going to try anyway, and then is tragically killed by forces in that city as well. But this is really more of a pessimistic view again of even Thomas Wayne and philanthropy and stuff like that, because, you know, even when faced with, you know, this mentally ill person of Arthur, and, you know, it's interesting, like in how Thomas and how Alfred react when they know who he is. Because, you know, at first when I saw that scene with Alfred and young Bruce, when he says you're, I think his mom's name is Penny. I think what he says, like, you know, you're Penny's boy. You know, like, I thought it was more of like a, you know, like, oh God, you know, the illegitimate child, we can't do this. But watching it the second time, no, Alfred knows what this kid went through. And it's more of a pity in his eyes when he says that. It's just like, Jesus, man, you're like still alive. Like, how did you even survive what happened to you type thing? But Thomas is almost the complete opposite. He just doesn't have time. And I think that's probably a play on politicians in this time and age, don't you think?
Yeah, I think it's a riff on that. I think the movie's really trying to address, you know, poverty politics with the poor and the wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
I also think, you know, when we have characters like that, like in the real world, sometimes they don't have time too, and sometimes they are annoyed that this creepy dude was
coming up to me in the bathroom, calling me dad.
Yeah, him. And sometimes you know, hell, the Pope just slapped a lady for not letting go of his hand. I mean, it doesn't matter how good you are. Sometimes you had a bad day and you're rough. But I do think it was a riff off the poverty politics that are so prevalent in the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, honestly, when I first saw the movie, like the Bruce stuff, like I felt like was the kind of the most unneeded in the movie. I feel like the Bruce scene is kind of just an Easter egg of sorts, because, like, you know, really all we establish from that is that certain people in the Wayne world know who Arthur is. They know of him, you know, because they know of Penny's claims. But, you know, it kind of felt like a more of a fan service thing to me. But did you have a different reaction to that?
No, I did. I feel like that was 100% the studio saying, you will put this in.
You will put Bruce Wayne in this movie. Now,
I thought the Thomas Wayne stuff, like in the theater.
That was good.
How they ended it, I thought that was fine. It was just the Bruce scene. It did seem unnecessary. And to me, it 100% seemed like some exec at a studio saying, you have to have this. There has to be Batman in a Joker movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I have to say that, you know, there's some really deep, deep lines in this movie, you know, especially stuff that Arthur says to his social worker, and stuff that he writes in his journal and his joke books and stuff. You know, some of the most striking scenes are the ones that don't really, you know, long form payoff. They're just kind of there to paint a picture in a moment, like where Arthur's listening to a comedian in the club and, you know, he's trying to take notes, but he's also laughing like just past, like, you know, when everybody else does. So it's like even this, something he admires so much and that he's trying to learn from, he still can't quite get it, you know, like he still can't even quite figure out when to laugh at the right place and stuff. But the line that he writes in his journal that always, there's two lines he writes in his journal that stick out to me. One is, you know, I hope my death makes more sense than my life, but sense is spelled with, in the monetary, you know, part of the word, C-E-N-T-S, which, you know, you could break that one down for a while. And the other one, though, that always stuck out to me, and I'd love to get your opinions on this, is the worst part of having a mental illness is people always expect you to act like you don't. And that is a very, very profound line. What did you think of that line when you saw that?
Yeah, I mean, I think in addition, you know, there's a number of things trying to be addressed, but I think how we view mental illness and mental health as a whole in this country, I mean, yeah. I think that's something that gets talked a lot more about than it ever did. So I think that was him addressing that. Also, and playing up, you know, that he has a genuine mental illness. I mean, that's my take on it. I think he was just trying to bring light that we still don't really do a great job of how we address, as a whole, you know, mental illness and mental health issues, in this country. And I think that was some more of the stuff they were trying to point out with this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, another, you know, kind of point of criticism I've heard are the scenes with Arthur's neighbor, played by Zazie Beetz, in this movie. And, you know, I didn't, you know, see any problem with these. Somebody said that they were shot, like, you know, too jarringly or something, so, like, the payoff was obvious. I didn't see that payoff coming at all. I thought, you know, like, I was wondering where we were going here, but, like, that scene in the apartment where she walks in and doesn't know who he is, I mean, like, that was a jarring moment for me. I was just like, oh, Jesus, man. Like, this guy is a way more far gone than we have any idea about right now.
Yeah, I did not expect that either. And actually, when the first time I saw the movie, when she started acting weird, I was like, why is she acting? It took me a minute to even get what was going on.
I know, right?
And then I was like, oh, holy crap. I thought that was great, because I think that cues us in, you know, midway through the movie, it cues you in. And also, that's the point in the movie where they show that, and then you start to literally question everything that's happened in the movie.
Yeah.
And all the way till the end, and you still question it. You know, you still don't know exactly what was real, what was not real. And mm-hmm. I think that was the thing that cued us off halfway through the movie, which was great, because all the way from that point on, you start going, is it real or is it his imagination?
Yeah.
I love that ambiguity where you have – the viewer has to make their own choice on it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And because- to me – That's a Joker movie, man. You
well, that's no, it. I mean, like, yeah, like that evokes to me, like, that's the memory of Heath Ledger that sticks out the most in The Dark Knight, is like how he kept telling different versions of his origin story. And yeah. You're like, well, I mean, are any of these true? Like, you
know? And I love probably that. Not. I loved it. That to me made it feel like, oh, this is a Joker movie. Because yeah. I don't know exactly what's going on. And that's his superpower, right? His superpower is chaos.
Yeah.
And even though he wasn't displaying it as a power thing, they used the movie to display that, you know?
Yeah, and also just definitely his ability to inspire other people to take part in that chaos, which again is also part of what Heath Ledger's up to in The Dark Knight, you know, like trying to show how civilized people will eat each other when the chips are down, you know, and stuff yeah. like that. So, yeah, and I think – so I get the sense – and Jay, tell me if you think I'm off here, but – after that scene, you know, where she says, you know, you're in the wrong apartment, we see the flashes to where she wasn't really there with him at all of these pivotal moments. And then he looks back at her and, you know, does the gun to the head thing. You know, we go back to his apartment and we hear sirens. Did you take that to mean that they were dead then, that he killed them?
I didn't. And I'll tell you what, I know they like put out the notes that said whether they did or didn't. And I never read that.
Yeah, I didn't either.
Just because when the two guys that were from the clown,
the company there,
whatever you call it,
yeah,
came over and he didn't kill the little guy.
Yeah,
because he said you were always nice to me.
Yeah,
and I don't think his neighbor was ever mean to him.
Right.
So I think in his own weird little, principled way of looking at life, that he wouldn't have done that.
Yeah. Well, no, that's a very good point, because yeah, like, you know, like at this point, the killing that he personally intakes, you're right, is to someone he feels personally slighted by. You know, obviously the guy who gave him the gun and then lied about it, to save his own ass, Murray, you know, on the show when he's, you know, basically taking his revenge for making fun of him on a previous episode of that show. Yeah. Like all of his killing, you know, the guys on the subway, they're literally physically accosting him. So, you know, you're right. There's always a causality to that in terms of somebody wronging him. And that's interesting to me, because that scene with where he kills the clown, but doesn't kill the midget clown, is that's like the first kind of burst of real violence we get. You know, I know like the shooting is a violent act as well, but
That was like a reaction, though.
Yeah, but that is some brutal violence for the first time in this movie. I mean, did that jar you as much as it jarred me? Like, just seeing how brutally he kills this guy?
Yes. Yeah, very, very much so. I don't think I knew that was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the whole – like, anybody that said, I saw this coming and that coming, that's crazy to me, because I didn't – I was never quite prepared for where – anything was going.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I always felt so bad, like I wasn't sure if I was supposed to laugh at the guy not being able to reach the lock. I mean, like, I think you're supposed to, but like, he's so freaking terrified, and like Arthur, he just like looks back and he's just like smiling, like, all right, you know, like it's like there's nothing just like, even wrong.
I'll help you. No problem.
It's so just weird.
Brutally murdering a man. Yeah.
It's so weird, man.
I think it was. I think there was supposed to still be sprinkled humor. I mean, that's like also, you know, elements of Joker in there.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I remember seeing one review of this that said, you know, like if the, if the Dark Knight tagline would be "Why so serious?" then this Joker's movie would probably be "What's so funny?" You know, and you know, you kind of get that sense. And that kind of really manifests itself, I think, in that scene with Murray Franklin. And I was going to say, I thought De Niro was fabulous in this movie. I think like the way he plays kind of that, you know, you get the sense that Murray Franklin likes to think of himself as like more ordinary folk than, you know, than somebody in his position typically would, you know, like, yeah, I mean, like, cause did you get that sense? Because like when he's doing the debate with Arthur, you know, like you get this sense that he's trying to like speak for the everyday man or something like that. But it's just like, you know, Arthur rightly points out, just like, you don't know what's happening out there. Have you ever even left the studio type thing? Like, let's break down that scene a little bit. What was your wholesale reaction? What did you notice the most in that Murray Franklin scene?
I think that, like, first of all, him coming down those steps, like I said, is when he becomes the Joker. To me, there's two characters.
Yeah.
There's Arthur Fleck and there's the Joker.
Yeah, no, you're
and
right.
To me, when it's in the middle of that interview, you know, cause he, like you said, he's always delayed on that laughter, watching the comedian earlier in the movie. And in his humor, he finally just says, I don't care what you think is funny. This is my funny. This is my humor. You know, it wasn't funny at all. It was just jarring stuff that he was saying and doing. And he was just basking in it. And to me, that's when the turn was complete. Like, that's when he was.
Yeah, when he's doing that little jig as he sees the cops getting, you know, beaten up and stuff. He's doing that little dance and then just walks away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think in the middle of that interview, when he turns that course from kind of being awkward, and he's still awkward in a way, but he's confident in his awkwardness. Mm. And that's one thing I think I did see where he was indicating he was going to kill himself. And that's where I think you go, oh, that's not what he's going to do. That's he's going to kill himself.
Yeah, that was interesting to me. It's like, you know, like I think, you know, when you see him rehearsing that, you know, you kind of think to yourself, well, yeah, I guess that'd be the natural place where someone like this would go. But, you know, you're right. Like once he starts kind of fully seeing what his, you know, actions have wrought, so to speak, it's interesting to me, like in that interview, you know, he clearly points out, you know, like I'm not political, like I don't care about any of that stuff. And it's interesting to me because I think it's kind of bullshit. You know, I think Arthur's kind of bullshitting a little bit there.
Maybe here's my take on it. I think he's more basking in the showmanship of it than the actual politics of it.
There you go. That's a good way to put it.
I think he likes being loved and appreciated, but I don't really think he cares what the end result of any of it is.
Right, exactly. And I think that's such an interesting way that they couch the dialogue in this scene too, because there's part of it that's just so stark to me because, you know, he talks about killing the three guys and, you know, like he says a line that's actually like pretty profound for like how, you know, certain people view other people in the society, which is just like, I killed them because they were awful, you know, like they were awful people. And, you know, then he immediately has to follow it up with like, and they couldn't carry a tune, you know. It's just like so weird. It's like, I don't know how to feel about that. But, you know, then the big, I mean, like if there's a big, like, take this movie seriously societal line in that, it is, you know, that sense of just like, you know, if these guys weren't bankers, you wouldn't give a crap. You know, like if these guys weren't rich people, you wouldn't care. If it was me dying on the street, you'd just step over my body, you know, like stuff like that. That's kind of where the film, I think, tries to be earnest. I mean, were you getting the same sense there?
Yeah, no, I agree. And one thing with that whole Murray scene, you know, where you start questioning, is this actually happening? Is he actually still in the mental institution, all that?
Right, right.
Part of that too, this second time I watched it, I was like, is Murray really just him arguing with viewpoints in his own head?
Maybe it is.
And I started thinking, and then I'm like, I don't know. I don't know what I think.
That stuff gets really crazy. Well, and I got to say, like, you know, the way they did the shot and, you know, like it's – again, it's like you feel the tension rising in the score. And by the way, this score better win best, you know, original score, because it's a fantastic film score. That's all I'm going to say.
But I paid a lot more attention to it after I've heard you talking about it on a couple of things and on our chat group. Because I'm like, I don't even remember the score from the first time I watched it.
But that's kind of the brilliance of it. It kind of just merges with the scene. The music does.
Yeah.
That's really hard to do sometimes, especially in a drama this hardcore.
Yeah, and you're right, though. I noticed. I'm like, oh, wow. And, where that tension was really coming from.
Yeah, and she, well, I mean, like, she, the composer, Hildur, she, uses a lot of what Zimmer did with The Dark Knight, which, you know, the Joker theme in that movie was really just a bunch of cellos and violins, you know, slowly moving up and holding the note, but just slowly, slowly moving up and getting higher and higher in pitch so that it just felt like tension, like you're just twisting like this string or this wire, and it's eventually going to snap. And it really starts to do that at that point where he's, you know, oh, how about another joke? And Murray's trying to cut it off and stuff. And finally just culminates in that gunshot to the head. And it's just like, you know, again, like even after everybody's like running away in panic, he shoots him again. You know, he looks like he's going back for a third one and then just drops the gun. And then he does his like little jig dance again. And it's like, this guy doesn't know what to do. Like, you know, like, and now he's just kind of like, you know, he's kind of like the Heath Ledger version. He's just a dog chasing cars. Like, I don't know what I'm going to do. Like, yeah. he's just doing stuff to do chaos. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, and I thought that one of the, like, I really appreciated the ending frames of this movie, not just the scene in the hospital again in Arkham, but, the scenes on the street, you know, where, you know, he gets, the ambulance like crashes into the cop car, and then, you know, he kind of fully embraces the adulation, as you said. And I thought that the shot of him taking the blood in his mouth and making the smile, that I thought was just gold filmmaking. Like that was just brilliant filmmaking there. I mean, what did you think of this whole weird, you know, on the street sequence?
I loved it. Cause I was like, I just thought it was going to end with him in the cop car and then in the mental institution. And him just smiling at all the crazy that's going on, out on the streets. And then when that ambulance hit the cop car and I was like, what is happening?
Where are we going now?
Yeah. Once again, I had no clue. I did not expect that at all. I thought the culmination on the late show was the culmination. I thought that was it, but I actually really liked that bit where he is, you know, the spotlight. He's in the spotlight in front of everybody. Mm-hmm. And I also like the ending, which I know some people were a little mixed on, but I loved it because I think it helped add to the ambiguity of the story.
Yeah. And I'll say this, like the very first time, like, so obviously the ending we're talking about with the doctor at the hospital, and he walks slow-mo out of the room and you see the blood-stained footprints he's leaving behind. Obviously he's killed that doctor and he's running away from the guards every which direction in slow motion while Sinatra's That's Life plays over and everything. And, you know, I think that the one line that bugged me was, it's a great line to end the movie on where he says, you know, like, I was thinking about a joke and you wouldn't get it, you know, like, and I think that that's like very telling of Arthur's character and actually very keeping in tone with the movie. But I also think it's kind of Todd Phillips giving himself an out. That's kind of like, if you didn't get this film, like, oh, well, you just don't get it. You know what I mean? Like, I kind of took it as like a, you know, Todd Phillips telling everyone is just like, well, if you don't like this movie, then you just didn't get it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I could see that just based off – he should avoid speaking in public about certain things.
Yeah.
but I also think that line really is another thing that adds to the ambiguity. Was the joke the whole movie and he just imagined it in his head?
Right.
And part of the other thing that added to that vagueness for me was the doctor he was talking to, an older black female. Just like the social worker. So I was like, oh, you know, it's not the same actress, but is that supposed to be like...
Looks hey, very similar, though. Looks yeah, very they similar.
So that to me was like, oh, maybe he was just imagining her in his imagination, a version of her as his social worker throughout it. So I love that end scene just because it just kept the brain going.
Yeah. I mean, like, and look, there's already talk. I mean, this movie made $1 billion worldwide. There's already talk about a second one, coming out about it. Now there's no real connection to any of the DCEU films right now. And I think that that's probably their plan. I don't think they want to connect it to, any kind of those universes. But then my question is, in the Arrowverse Infinite Crisis event that just happened, you just merged that universe with the DCEU movie universe. So are we just on a bunch of different crossover Earths here? I don't know. Maybe you see Joaquin Phoenix show up on the CW someday, kids.
Maybe. I hope they don't make a sequel.
I
think it could be a standalone. I get it.
What do you do with it? You know, like, you almost inherently have to bring in a Batman component, don't you?
Yeah. And here's what I would absolutely love to see. And I don't know, I think I've mentioned this to you through some message or something before, but I think every year or two, they should make a brand new Joker movie, brand new actor, writer, director, do their own take on it, make it an anthology. And then you go, well, which one's the real one? Which one's the actual Joker story?
You know what?
I think you get these awesome. Some of them have Batman. Some of them don't. I think that'd be
awesome. So in on that idea, my man. I am so in on that. Yeah, just like an anthology of Joker origin stories. And like, well, which one's the real one? It's just like the comic books. Nobody knows. There's no definitive one. There's like 12 of them out there and none of them have been said. DC's never said which one's real. I mean, so.
Yeah, I mean, like the Bond movies aren't, I mean, the latest ones they've tried to connect, but generally aren't really connected, you know?
Yeah.
That's more or less an anthology series. I don't know why they couldn't do it with Joker.
Yeah, I like that idea a lot, man. We're gonna put that out on Facebook, man. We're gonna see if people are down with that. Maybe WB will get a hold of that one, man, because that's a good idea. Damn, man, you need to trademark that idea right now.
I'm a good idea factory.
There you go. Well, and I don't like. I know that both of us like this movie, but I did want to give a little bit of a moment because there was one line from Phil Rockwell, our writer on the front row, his review of this movie. There is one line that kind of makes me grapple a little here, and I definitely want to get your opinion on this. And I know you're hearing this for the first time, so you know we'll give a little bit of leeway here. But in Phil's kind of final paragraph of this, he states it like this. He says, Joker puts so much of its narrative momentum behind establishing Arthur Fleck as the victim of forces beyond his control that it's hard to read the film as anything other than a justification for his homicidal heel turn. Where do the filmmakers expect their hard-earned sympathy for Arthur to stop? Where is the line? Should we be okay with some of the murders, but not others? Are they all bad? You know, and he says that Arthur's story parallels too many real world tragedies for the filmmakers to so brazenly sidestep questions like this. It's a very interesting perspective that I hadn't considered from this. It's kind of what we talked about before. And, you know, like, are you sympathizing with the villain or with the psychopath here? How do Phil's words hit you there when you're just now hearing them for the first time?
I understand what he's saying, but I think it's going to depend on the person.
Yes.
By the end of the movie, I did not feel bad for Arthur Fleck.
No, I didn't either. That's exactly my point too.
But I could definitely see somebody who, you know, got picked on, had a rough time going, I kind of understand what he's going through. So
yeah.
I think it's the eye of the beholder.
Yeah,
for me, I mean, personally, because I didn't feel.
Yeah, there's plenty of stories in the world where you see the reason, you see the thread line and the logic behind why somebody does something terrible, but you don't have to empathize with it. You know, you don't have to, you know, or even sympathize with it. Now, I understand that we're playing with a very complex, murky water here when it's like, it's very hard not to empathize and not to sympathize, or it's very hard not to sympathize with Arthur in this movie. You see all these terrible things happening to a human being. You sympathize with that. But then do you also feel what he feels and take that feeling upon yourself, which is what empathy is? I don't think so. I don't think it goes that far.
Yeah. And I think some of it's like, we always want people to stand up for themselves when people are doing bad stuff to them. We always want that, but not the way he did it. Like, no. There's standing up for yourself, and then there's just going off of the deep end. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think happened. And there's a little Easter egg in the movie I wanted to mention, because I just, to me, it sums up kind of what we're talking about. You know, there's defending yourself and going over the edge. When he goes to that theater to go see Thomas Wayne, I don't know if you remember the movie playing.
Yeah.
It's Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times.
Modern Times.
It's the part the very famous roller skating scene where he's skating right near the edge of like a 3-story drop off. And he just keeps skating right on the edge. And I mean, that was very intentional. Scene being shown there. And that's what it is. He was teetering on the edge instead of defending himself in a meaningful and appropriate way. He crossed the line. And like I said, I didn't have any empathy for that. None whatsoever. I did not take this as a justification. I took this as an explanation. And to me, those are two separate things. But like I said, I also understand where Phil's coming from, and I can absolutely see where somebody might take it that way. And to me, that makes the film even more, I don't know, all this, you know, it's confusing, it's muddy, it's cloudy, it's hard to make these choices. That to me adds to the quality of the movie, doesn't take away from it.
Yeah. And, you know, I wrote this as my best drama of the year in our year-end article. And I wrote, and it's still the thing I feel about this. I said, it's not empathy for the criminal that's going on here. It's rather it's empathy for the downtrodden. And then there's the danger of assuming they'll never do anything about it. You know, and I think that's kind of the inherent message, if you will, that I took away from this is that, you know, it's so easy for those in power to just ignore. But trust me when I tell you, there's plenty of examples of history of, you know, people rallying behind stuff that, you know, and doing bad things because they feel like nobody hears or sees them. And I think that is kind of the inherent bad point that's being taken here.
Yeah. And I also thought of all the political things that was, you know, under attack, you know, how we treat mental illness, poverty, politics. I also thought this movie was an attack on populism.
Oh, yes.
So if you make the argument that it's justifying his actions, to me, it was saying, hey, here's the dangers of people justifying these actions and getting together as groups and just buying into that narrative. And so I think in addition to an explanation, it was examining kind of some of the stuff that's happening in this country. Cause right now, left and right, you got populism
all over.
Oh yeah. Going crazy. And I think it was an attack on that.
Yeah. I mean, definitely you could see that definitely in the clown cult that arises from literally like, yeah, Arthur never like goes out and says, I did this. He never even like releases like a, you know, like an anonymous manifesto, like, oh yes, this is because the rich don't care for us. He's so detached from that act. It's kind of strange to see all of this fervor grow from, you know, seemingly what must be a rant, completely random act to the populace of Gotham. You know, like, it's not like there's a central figure for this to be around, but then again, I guess that's how it becomes it's not just one clown. It's all of us. We're all clowns. And Thomas Wayne saying, you know, people who would do this, they're not reaching their potential are all clowns and stuff like that.
Yeah.
No, that's you got me thinking now. I think, damn, we might need a series of articles on this movie.
We gotta watch it 3 or 4 more times.
I'm telling you,
your mind on everything.
I'm finding something new every time I talk about it. Well, as we said, this film is nominated for 11 Academy Awards this year. It is the most. I was not expecting that. I was expecting a good amount. You know, in recent history, the most nominated film hasn't necessarily left with the most awards. I think the last time that happened was Return of the King, if I remember correctly.
This is not Return of the King.
This is not Return of the King. No, I think I'm very confident in Phoenix winning Best Actor. I'm very hopeful that Hildur wins the Best Original Score. But other than that, I mean, I don't know. Like, you know, it could, I guess it's a contender for all of these. I can see it contending, but, you know, it just seems to be some heavy hitters in some of those other categories that I think is kind of limited to maybe 2 or 3 wins.
Yeah. And you guys have said it on a few of the other podcasts. It's just, there's so many awesome movies.
This was a stupid year in quality.
I don't remember the last time, honestly. Well, one, you guys have gotten me more interested in the award season than I've been in a long time. I kind of stopped caring about that business because I was talking to you guys. But really, just reflecting back the last, I don't even know how many years, I'm just kind of like, eh.
Yeah.
I don't know. I might have the year wrong. Was it maybe 2008 when No Country for Old Men, There Will Be Blood. Like, that to me was like a powerhouse year.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you'd have to go back quite a ways to have a year. And, but that was just, you know, a handful of movies. This one is like easily 10 more that are just phenomenal.
Yeah. No, and I mean, like, I wrote it in the Golden Globes reaction. It's just like, I saw 10 Best Actor nominees at that ceremony, and I could see literally every one of them get nominated for Best Actor. I mean, it's just, it's an embarrassment of riches this year. I think that's due to Netflix, honestly. I think that they're raising everybody's game a bit because they're able to produce content way quicker than anyone else. And I think that, yeah, I mean, everybody's just kind of embracing that the way, like the kind of stories they're telling. Because you look, it's not even just that there's a bunch of great movies this year. They're all so different from each other this year. And they're all like, there's really something for everyone. I mean, the last time I can remember of this kind of diversity was Mad Max Fury Road's year. And if you remember, that Oscar ceremony was literally all over the place. Like, people were winning stuff. I mean, the acting categories were pretty known that year, but man, those awards just kept going to different people that you did not expect that year. So I think we might be in for that again. And I think that that's never more apparent than the fact that Joker is your top nominee getter in a year this stacked.
Yeah. That's still, especially after watching some of the others, it's still really surprising to me that it's got the most, but it was good, man. It's a great movie. And I think it has a lot to say, and it's going to be discussed for years. And I think a lot of stuff from that and a few other movies are going to be iconic shots that end up in movie highlight reels, like Indiana Jones running from the boulder and Vader and Luke Skywalker fighting. I think the dance down the steps, man, that's one of them already. I think one of the most iconic scenes in film already. And it's new movie. And somehow this movie also, for being as crazy as it was, what, $1 billion box office?
Yep, $1 billion worldwide.
That also blows my mind. It's not a movie that seems like would have the mass appeal that...
I know. A hardcore psychological drama made $1 billion this year. What is this movie year?
Yeah.
Nobody knows.
Well, I think that goes... So, you know, with people going to the theaters, you know, people aren't going as much as they used to. And this was, it was in the vein of superheroes, sort of.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's superhero adjacent at least.
Yeah. And I think they did that. I think there was reasons for that. But because this wouldn't have made $1 billion if it was called Arthur Fleck.
No. No, you're right. I mean, like, Joker is what gets it. I mean, like, that's why you get $1 billion out of it. But you can't just make a Joker movie and make $1 billion. It's got to be made well, you know?
I think audiences, honestly, are scratching for some more diversity in the theatrical releases than we've had the last few years. And I think this, even though, like you said, superhero adjacent, definitely takes a hard turn away from the big popcorn stuff, which we also love, but I think it shows there's a diversity of stuff we want to see in theaters.
Yes, Avengers Endgame, this is not. That's the tagline. There it is. Boom. That's the review. All right. Look, everybody, this was a great discussion. We want to know what you thought of Joker as well. You can find us anywhere online. The Front Row Network on Facebook and Instagram, Front Row Reviews with a Z on Twitter. And of course, on our websites, frnpod.com or mprillinois.org. Look, you've got a ton more Oscar spotlights coming to you. And then of course, the week of the ceremony, we're going to be giving you literally an episode a day, breaking down all 24 categories at the Oscars, 6 episodes, 4 categories an episode, and we're going to give you our best guesses as to what to expect from the big night. And then, of course, the night itself, February 9th, Sunday night, we will be holding our second annual Front Row Oscars party at the Hoagland Center for the Arts. If you want to get tickets for that, go to hcfta.org. If you want to come and party it up and watch it with us, either way, we'll also be doing our live reactions on every single commercial break. Jay, you got anything else you want to say before we sign off here?
I do not. I look forward to the Oscar party. I'm pretty excited.
Damn right. Everybody should be. Get those tickets. They're going fast, people. All right. So that is going to do it for this episode of the Oscar Spotlights. I am Jeremy Gechner.
Jay Hoffman.
And as always, we will see you in the front row.
This episode is a production of the Front Row Network, a proud Community Voices member of National Public Radio, Illinois. For more information and to see the full slate of Front Row Network shows, you can visit frnpod.com or nprillinois.org.